You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to this podcast on spondyloarthritis hosted by Med Learning Group. This podcast is second in a series of two geared towards rheumatologists and other caregivers involved in the management of spondyloarthritis. In our first podcast, we discussed the different subtypes of spondyloarthritis, and here in our second, we'll focus a bit more on treatment strategies. Again, my name is Chris, and I'll be the host of today's podcast. So I'd like to once again welcome Dr. Alexis Agdi, who is back with us for our second podcast. Dr. Agdi, once again, is an associate professor of medicine and epidemiology at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. She's also director of the Penn Psoriatic Arthritis Clinic at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Agdi, thank you very much for participating with us once again.
Thanks so much for having me.
So here in our second podcast, I wanted to focus a bit more on treatments for spondyloarthritis. So let's start with the axial subtype. Just give us a quick overview of what's available for both the radiographic and non-radiographic types of axial spondyloarthritis.
Great. So really, treatment for axial spondyloarthritis is basically the same whether it's non-radiographic or radiographic. You might be a little bit more kind of aggressive with someone who's radiographic, but other than that, the options are still the same. So the first option or the first recommended therapy for all patients with axSpA is physical therapy. And I think this is interesting because this is the one that's missed the most when people come to me, they haven't done physical therapy. And this is so critical because building those core muscles, for example, and then stretching the rest of the back and the hamstrings and everything is so important for good back health. So good back health is particularly important for our patients with axSpA. So this is a plug to get every patient with axSpA into physical therapy at least some point, and then they should continue doing those exercises. In addition, NSAIDs have been really a cornerstone therapy for axSpA. And that's, you know, often we start that as a first therapy, and we might give it a couple weeks to see if that's enough. Often it's not enough, but for a subset of the population, using NSAIDs is sufficient. There was a nice study presented at the ACR this year that suggested that the cardiovascular risks associated with NSAIDs weren't that significantly different among patients with axSpA that were using NSAIDs compared to those who were not. Which is a little bit, feels better because I think the main concern with NSAIDs is always that there's increased risk for cardiovascular disease and chronic kidney disease. But what we see in some of the studies of axSpA and have seen in other studies in RA is that when you're treating inflammation with the NSAID, it doesn't have the same maybe level of risk, although we still have to counsel on that risk. So NSAIDs for all, but no, just to back that up, NSAIDs as needed to treat the inflammation. Now, if the NSAID isn't enough, that's when we move on to kind of more advanced therapies. In axSpA, the most common therapies used are the TNF inhibitors, the IL-17 inhibitors, and the JAK inhibitors. Those are the only three sets of therapies that have data that suggests that they work for both radiographic and non-radiographic disease. Long ago, we used to use sulfasalazine, but they're really only role for sulfasalazine is in peripheral disease. So if you have peripheral arthritis in addition to the axSpA, you can use the sulfasalazine to help treat the peripheral. But when we're treating the axial disease itself, it's really TNF inhibitor, IL-17 inhibitor, or a JAK inhibitor. And this past year, we saw the first head-to-head study presented among a TNF inhibitor versus an IL-17 inhibitor. And the good news is they work identically. So when they compared adalimumab to secukinumab, there was really no difference in radiographic progression, for example, or any one of the outcomes. They were all identical and laid basically on top of each other. So I think that demonstrates that really the TNF inhibitors and IL-17 inhibitors are equivalent. And we've seen with upadacitinib studies that suggest that UPA is very similar to adalimumab as well. So probably all three categories are equally effective. And furthermore, when you take the graph or the study from radiographic axSpA and the study from non-radiographic axSpA and you line them up right next to each other, the drugs look to work almost identically in those two populations. So you can expect very similar results from both. Because ideally, these medicines are treating inflammation. They're obviously not going to treat damage.
Okay, so that's a great overview of what's available for the axial subtype of spondyloarthritis. So let's move on to peripheral. And maybe we can focus here on the most common subtype of psoriatic arthritis. Is it the same general panel of treatments that's used for axial disease?
Yeah. So if you have psoriatic arthritis and axial disease, then the panel of treatments is exactly the same as axial disease. You essentially follow that algorithm, but you might tweak it based on how much skin disease there is, for example, or if someone has really bad nail disease. In that case, maybe we're going to lean toward an IL-17 inhibitor. Or if they have overlapping IBD, maybe you're going to lean to some of the TNF inhibitors or the JAK inhibitors, for example. So axial disease, go with the axial pathway. On the other hand, if there's no known axial disease, now our treatment categories expand and we have many more options. So beyond the TNFs, IL-17s, and JAK inhibitors, if they only have peripheral disease, then we have ustekinumab, an IL-12/23 inhibitor. We have two IL-23 inhibitors, guselkumab and risankizumab. We have phosphodiesterase 4 inhibitor, apremilast, which is going to be more like the other oral therapies. And we have the other oral therapies like methotrexate, sulfasalazine, leflunomide, for example. There's also abatacept, which has been around for a long time for rheumatoid arthritis, but it tends to work like it does for rheumatoid arthritis, meaning only really for the peripheral disease. It really doesn't help the skin at all. So it's less commonly used in psoriatic disease.
So how about IBD-associated spondyloarthritis, which we haven't talked much about? Are the treatment options similar to that type as well?
IBD-associated arthritis is a little challenging. So we often will work closely with our gastroenterologists to figure out how to treat these patients. So first of all, treatments for Crohn's and ulcerative colitis differ. They're not exactly the same. Among the TNF inhibitors, etanercept doesn't work for either one. However, adalimumab and infliximab work for both Crohn's and ulcerative colitis. But certolizumab is approved for Crohn's disease and golimumab is approved for ulcerative colitis. So you first of all have to know which form of IBD do they have. Additionally, you have to know how active their IBD is and should we be, you know, targeting that or should we be targeting the arthritis? Sometimes they don't go well together. And so you have to kind of figure out what's going to work with both. So beyond the TNF inhibitors, if a patient has IBD, we're obviously avoiding the IL-17 inhibitors because that can exacerbate IBD. But the JAK inhibitors are approved for IBD and as are is ustekinumab for Crohn's disease in particular. And then interleukin-23 inhibitors are kind of coming into the IBD space. And not only that, they have vedolizumab, which is kind of a localized one. So occasionally, if we're having trouble taking care of both, we may combine biologics in that setting where the patient's getting vedolizumab, for example, for their Crohn's or ulcerative colitis. And then we're giving them a TNF inhibitor or a JAK inhibitor, for example, for their peripheral arthritis or for their inflammatory arthritis. So it's tricky for sure and really important to work with a gastroenterologist in figuring out what's what. I think the other complicating part is that IBD-associated arthritis, not only do they have the opportunity to have fibromyalgia and make our joint decisions complicated, they also have the opportunity to have IBS and make their inflammatory bowel disease management complicated. So that's where really talking through it and looking at the scope, for example, and saying how active is the IBD versus the joint disease is really important.
It sounds like an extreme challenge to separate out between subtypes and then figure out kind of what's the underlying cause and what's related and not related and combining treatments and all this. It sounds pretty complicated.
At least, you know, you can always start with adalimumab or infliximab. That's the easy part. Once you get beyond those two, that's when it gets a lot more complicated.
So I wanted to hone in a little bit on the IL-17 inhibitors. There's been a lot of research lately on this class with several agents approved for both axial and peripheral spondyloarthritis. Give us a little background on IL-17 and how it's become a target for treating spondyloarthritis over the last few years.
Yeah, I think we learned a lot more about IL-17 in the last 10 years. I think we're continuing to learn more about interleukin-17 as we get new therapies that are in this range, this kind of targeting IL-17. So interleukin-17 is part of the inflammatory pathway, the Th17 inflammatory pathway. So to kind of back up, there's Th1, Th2, Th17. We think it's kind of downstream from interleukin-23. So if you drive up IL-23, you tend to then drive up interleukin-17, for example. And so the thought is that targeting IL-17 helps bring down the inflammation and kind of cut off that loop. We also know that Th17 is important for fungal, taking care of fungal infections and some bacterial infections. So then it's not surprising that sometimes you see that when someone is an IL-17 inhibitor, they may have more fungal infections, although it's still really relatively uncommon, like around 3-5% of patients. So, but you can see that as well.
So the data show pretty clear efficacy of IL-17 inhibitors for both axial and peripheral spondyloarthritis. But there's also been some trials looking at ancillary aspects of the disease, such as radiographic progression, pain, sleep, work productivity, et cetera, et cetera. What are some of the results of these trials that you've seen?
Yeah, so IL-17 inhibitors, first of all, there's secukinumab, and then there was ixekizumab, and then brodalumab. So secukinumab and ixekizumab are both IL-17A inhibitors. And then brodalumab is an IL-17 receptor blocker. So it's more widespread blockade of IL-17. And then the most recent new therapy is bimekizumab, and that's IL-17A and F, currently only approved in the U.S. for psoriasis, but approved in Europe and Japan for PSA and axSpA and psoriasis. So eventually coming here for that too. So when you look at these different targets, whether in all of the different studies, let's take brodalumab out because they ended development for PSA and axSpA after some adverse events in the psoriasis group. They saw more suicidal ideation in the psoriasis trials. But in the IL-17A inhibitors, across those trials, you see pretty good inhibition of radiographic damage, and especially secukinumab and ixekizumab, reduced pain, improved sleep, improved work productivity, improved patient-reported outcomes across the board, including fatigue. And I think we see that in clinic too. Once you start these therapies, patients do start to feel better within 4 to 6 weeks in general. And so in addition to that, these are highly effective psoriasis therapies. So they can clear psoriasis in 4 weeks in some cases. And actually when these first came into trials in the dermatology space, there was a worry because you couldn't blind the trials because patients got better so fast. So overall, really great therapies. And I think the question that we've always had is, how do you put those in context with the TNF inhibitors? Because we've had the TNF inhibitors for so long. And so that now has been three different head-to-head studies comparing TNF to IL-17. There's adalimumab versus ixekizumab in PSA, adalimumab versus secukinumab in PSA, and then adalimumab versus secukinumab in axSpA, in radiographic damage. So it was in AS, basically. And in all three of those studies, for the joints, the curves really lay on top of each other. They're essentially identical. The main difference is really if the patient has psoriasis, these are much more effective therapies for patients with psoriasis than a TNF inhibitor, for example.
Well, it's great to have that, you know, fairly new class of agents. I mean, we had the TNF inhibitors for quite a while, and then IL-17s came, and now we have some others. But it seems like it was a great class to come along to help these patients. But let's shift gears to the burden of this disease. You alluded to several of these things in our discussion, but what are your thoughts overall on how spondyloarthritis conditions affect quality of life? Like what's most important to your patients? Is it pain relief, employment or ability to work, daily functioning, cost? What's important to your patients?
Yeah, I often talk about treating the whole patient. And so, you know, one of the things is first understanding how the disease is impacting them, as you said. So sometimes it's purely pain. And if you get the pain and the swelling down, they have more function. Sometimes it kind of reaches wider into function, including work productivity, for example, or ability to sleep. And then if you can't sleep, you're not functional either. If you're really fatigued, you're really not being able to function at the level you want to function. So I think all of these things impact patients. And then there's depression and anxiety that affect about a third of our patients, up to a third of our patients. And those have implications for function, but they also have implications for therapy longevity. For example, patients who are anxious or depressed with either axSpA or PSA tend to have more therapy switching or less persistence on therapy, and they rate their disease control as worse overall. There's a variety of ways approaching this problem. One is you can use something like the PROMIS 29 in clinic. It's a free questionnaire you can download online, or you can have them do it on an iPad. And then it gives you a sense of how their sleep, their pain, their fatigue, depression, anxiety, physical function, social impairment are, and how they're doing across all those different domains. And then you can start building a plan that not only integrates the therapy that you're going to give them so that their disease gets better, but also how to target some of those individual things. So if it's depression and anxiety, it's about referring them to someone who can help with that, whether that's a primary care physician or a mental health professional, for example. If it's pain that's continued despite therapy, considering non-opiate pain medications, for example, to help, like amitriptyline or duloxetine, for example. So I think it's really important first to understand what is it that's affecting that patient, and then build a plan that kind of addresses some of those different pieces.
So you mentioned a handful of comorbidities along the way, such as IBD, psoriasis, and others. In managing patients with spondyloarthritis, the rheumatologist is obviously the key member of the team. But what other caregivers are often brought on board to help manage the whole patient, as you mentioned?
Yeah, so I think a couple things. I kind of left the comorbidities off of that in some ways. I talked about depression and anxiety, but then we have this whole like group of metabolic comorbidities that affect our patients, in particular those with psoriasis or PSA, including increased risk for diabetes, increased risk for myocardial infarction. They tend to have higher prevalence of hypertension and obesity as well. And so we are in an optimal place to kind of see those things because we know these relationships. We also know the relationship with response to therapy. So what I recommend is just kind of including a letter, not a letter, a line in your plan that says cardiovascular risk and PSA. And then you say, you know, note when the last lipids were, or just order the lipids once a year to make sure that that's getting done. Making sure the primary care doctor knows about it as well so that you kind of have that in your letter to the primary care physician. And most of all, that the patient knows about these things so that they can address these things. So that broadens the care team then. So the primary care physician is really important to addressing some of those comorbidities, including cardiovascular risk. In addition, the dermatologist or the gastroenterologist if the patient has psoriasis or IBD. Ophthalmologist if the patient has uveitis, that can be a difficult one to monitor from a rheumatology perspective. And then others like mental health professionals, for example. If I could have every one of my patients see a dietitian, I would, because I think that patients benefit from having a nice, clean, healthy diet. That's one of our top questions that gets asked to us is what can I do with my diet? I wish I could send everyone to a dietitian. Unfortunately, it's often not covered. We have pharmacists in our clinic that help with the specialty pharmacy stuff. Oh, and that's just amazing because they can help direct the patient to the programs they need or help deal with the financial implications. I always tell patients that they get a really big bill just to let us know so that our pharmacists can help figure out what programs they may be eligible for. So all these pieces are important to kind of fit together. It's really nice to be in a healthcare system where you have all those people at your disposal, like Penn, for example, or some of the other academic health systems. We have access to all these people, but also in community settings, there's groups of community physicians that work together and have set up some of these relationships so they can refer back and forth. And the dermatologist, for example, knows about PSA and how you treat PSA. And so they don't change it to the medicine to a therapy that's not going to work for the PSA, for example. So those are the kinds of things that are valuable in terms of coming up with a multidisciplinary team for the patient with SPA.
Well, it definitely sounds like there's definitely a need to get multiple clinicians on board, and it truly takes a team to treat this disease. But let's end on this. There's been a huge push to involve and engage patients in their care. What are the benefits of making clinical decisions together with your patients?
Yeah, I think number one is the patient feels better about the choice being made. So if they're involved in making the decision, they're more likely to commit to the decision and stay on the therapy or try the therapy. Prescribing a patient a therapy that they're scared of, often they're going to be non-adherent or, you know, not started, and that could be more problematic. How do you do it? It's hard. So one of the things that I have is a handout that I give all patients in clinic that has all the therapies listed, and we literally go through them together, cross off the ones that they've had, and talk about, you know, whether they want oral or a subcutaneous injection, for example, kind of circle the different options. Then I allow them to take that home if they wanted to read more about some of them. I tell them where to find more information so that they can have some time to process it. Because when you're in the visit, sometimes it's just too much. We've also built an online version of this. It's on our PACMAN website, PPACMAN. It's called the Psoriasis Decision Aid. It needs to be updated, but it's a nice opportunity for patients to watch some videos about therapy and why we make these decisions about therapy or how we make the decision so that they can feel comfortable with talking through that decision with you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Agdi. I'm glad we could take some time to talk about how treatments have been designed across the years to hit different targets with better and better outcomes, along with tips for improving multidisciplinary care and shared decision-making with patients. But that's it for now. Once again, thank you, Dr. Agdi, for joining us, and thanks to all of our listeners for joining as well. As a reminder, MedLearning Group offers many types of CME programs across a variety of disease states, including several rheumatology topics. I invite you to explore these on our website, www.medlearninggroup.com. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group. MedLearning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. I would also like to give a special thank you to our grant supporter, Eli Lilly, who provided unrestricted grants for this educational activity. Thank you very much and have a great day.